Bloody Elbow presents the MMA Vivisection, the show that gives you a comprehensive breakdown and expert analysis of all the fights happening on this weekend's UFC card. Here are your hosts, Zane Simon and Connor Rebush.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-host, as always, Connor Rebush. We are here once again talking about this week's UFC card going down at the Moody Center in Austin, Texas. And it's a pretty decent fight night card headlined by Calvin Kattar versus Josh Emmett.
It's a very decent fight night card, actually. It's really flies in the face of the usual tradition.
It does, yeah.
Having a solid pay-per-view immediately followed up by utter trash.
I have to wonder just a little, and you know, maybe this is just one of those things that we'd like it not to be true, but it really, like, if I were thinking in the UFC's, doing the UFC's math, it would be very much the way I would do it, is that if you're not traveling, why stack a card? Like, if you don't have a gate to that you need to sell tickets for.
That makes perfect sense, actually. That, like, Apex Center.
Yeah.
Fight nights are just going to be like, whatever we got. That makes a perfect sense to me.
Right? Because, like, now suddenly they're in Austin. Card's pretty good. You look at the events coming up. You've got, you know, you go back to the Apex and suddenly you've got Saruki and Gamrot, which I don't dislike, but it is a card. It is a main event that people are widely panning because it was basically an afterthought.
Yeah.
And then, you know, suddenly,
even though it is a cool fight. I
mean, it's a cool fight. And then, you know, you got the RDA Fiziev. That's a great fight. So I can't really, maybe our theory already falls down, but certainly when you go into Long Island, Ortega versus Rodriguez card coming up with Burgos versus Jourdain and Ricky Simone versus Jack Shore on it, like, that's an awesome card.
And yeah, that's not a solid one. Algio Quarantillo.
Yeah.
Tillo, sorry, he's not Spanish speaking. Oh, yeah, exactly. That's a good card.
Yeah, right?
Oh, my God, that's like a pay-per-view undercard.
Yeah, so maybe there's something to it, maybe there isn't. It certainly is. The moment I just thought about that in my head, I'd be like, if I were the UFC, I would totally do that. Like, if I'm not trying to sell tickets and I don't have to worry about selling the airtime, why would I put on a good card for an Apex facility fight?
Yeah. I don't know. It also, maybe it's just a grab bag too. Like,
yeah, it's true.
I think the scheduling is just a lot less consistent overall than it used to be.
Yeah. They have a lot more fighters. They have more cards. And so they have more need to just get people booked all the time.
Yeah. And even more like uncertainty in bookings. So like you get more replacements, you get more people who are, can't travel. Like, there's just more obstacles in the way of making the best matchups possible.
Nonetheless, we're here to talk about Calvin Kattar versus Josh Emmett, and this is a quality card.
It's damn good, honestly. It's got a lot of great fights.
Let's dive right in to the main event here. Kattar, Emmett, two of middleweight or featherweights, rather, best punchers. And do you think that Calvin Kattar has so thoroughly channeled himself into thinking of himself as a puncher that he's going to get sparked by Josh Emmett?
You know, I think Calvin Kattar is a puncher, is the thing. And I also think he's mentally and physically tough enough to get away with not fighting any other way. I think he's
definitely
the toughest,
physically tough enough.
No, I think he's the toughest dude in the division. Like,
yeah, you might have something there
in terms of leveraging that toughness into just straight up using it as a weapon to win fights. Like, we know, like, Dan Ige is insanely tough.
Mm-hmm.
He went in there, he got dropped by Josh Emmett, didn't matter, came back, the fight was extremely close.
Yep.
Just went in there, ate a flush flying knee from Movsar Evloev in Evloev's best fight, best showing ever. And yeah, it wasn't hurt, you know, was just fine. But Dan Ige can't just like break people with pace or spark them out with a single shot.
Yeah.
Calvin Kattar can. So he could just throw his chin at people until they break both their hands hitting it, and then he kills them. To that question, which is a very interesting one, I would say simply that both of these men have fought Jeremy Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them had a Jeremy Stevens fight with Jeremy Stevens. Calvin Kattar won, and Josh Emmett didn't.
Yeah.
So I think they are similarly powerful, but Calvin Kattar is insanely tough.
He really is.
So if it becomes that kind of fight, it'll be amazing and thrilling, and I would strangely expect Kattar to win, even though Emmett seems like the more like dynamic puncher. I just doubt if he can finish Kattar. Who the hell can finish Calvin Kattar? Until it happens, yeah. I'm not going to bank on it to happen at all. Because he's
the
already.
The question is then, do you expect this to be any other kind of fight? Because I don't.
I don't know if it'll be a slugfest right from the jump. I have a feeling Emmett's going to try to be tactical.
That's bad news, though.
Well, I still think it'll be good. The thing is, I think Emmett can replicate a lot of the trouble that Dan Ige gave Calvin Kattar. Because that was not an easy fight. And it really was Kattar just sort of refusing to stop going forward and punching and breaking Ige and gassing him out, which in itself is very interesting because I don't know if I've ever seen Josh Emmett gassed out. He seems to be, like all alpha male fighters, spectacularly well-conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
But the difficulty for Kattar is he's a little foot slow. He can get a bit predictable. And especially if you go to the body, he's inconsistent as a defensive fighter. Like he actually used his defense better than I'd seen it in a while against Giga Chikadze.
Yeah, it's still one of those things where he's realized that his path to winning the fight largely involves walking straight into the teeth of their opponent and just outslugging them and
just never letting up. Yeah,
and never letting up. And even if you have a decent mind for defense, you're putting that a lot of that on the back burner to force that kind of fight.
Yes. Which, you know, maybe it isn't my favorite, but it does lead to some amazing fights. Like I'm a complete panty waste for complaining about it as much as I do. I'm the only person who watches these Calvin Kattar fights. I'm like, I wish he'd done this.
Yeah. I wish he'd just not, you know, I wish he hadn't pressed the fight so much. Stay on the back foot a little, let the other guy come forward. Like, come on, Calvin.
But yeah, he's going to keep walking into counters, and Emmett is fast, and that turns this into something that's, you know, more measured, I think. But it could ultimately look a little bit like Emmett's fight with Shane Burgos, which is his best performance, because I think Emmett, given somebody who just sort of inexorably comes into his range, can look super super sharp.
The thing with Emmett has always been that for a dude who tends to have who has had kind of a one track power game, that he's varied up a little over time. He's gotten a little more deft with it, but still it's largely, you know, a speed of punches coming at you. He throws those punches pretty equally as well off the back foot as the front foot. There's not a fight you can put on Emmett where he's not going to throw and have the kind of output that he wants and the kind of shots he wants.
Yeah, and it matters, the timing of his punches matters less when you're walking into them.
Mm-hmm.
When he's triggering off of your movements coming into his range, it doesn't matter as much as it does when he's like trying to walk you into a shot, when he's trying to come after you, and you have all the time and space in the world to be like, oh, that right hand is coming and get out of the way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think Emmett is really, really good as a back foot counterpuncher. But I do think it's going to become a war no matter what.
Yeah.
Because if Emmett tries to do Ige and Kattar comes to the same conclusion he came to in that fight and every other fight, he's going to just make Josh Emmett engage with him more and more. And I don't think Emmett's going to gas like Ige did, but I think he's probably going to get knocked out.
Yeah, that's a tough ask. I mean, I think, you know, it is worth noting that against Dan Ige, that really was a fight that depended on Emmett landing the bigger shots. Because there were a lot of straight exchanges in that fight where Ige just won them. Ige just was able to put out the better offense, land the better strikes, be a little sharper, a little more consistent with what he was throwing, and a little more varied. And he would have picked up rounds, except he just got hit really hard.
Mm-hmm. You know. And to be clear, when I was referencing Ige before, I'm talking about Cater Ige.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, for Emmett versus Ige, this is Emmett's most recent showing.
Yes.
Is he was faced by a guy who honestly has a lot of the same kind of game as Josh Emmett, frankly. A very in tight, not range attuned power puncher who will throw off the front foot or the back foot and is really most comfortable, in Ige's case, countering.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Ige was kind of winning that fight. You know, that was the dynamic of that fight did not favor Emmett, accepting that the power dynamic very much favored him.
Yeah.
And yeah, that is a concern against Calvin Kattar, because Calvin Kattar can have a lot of those kinds of fights, and he tends to be the one that makes the power dynamic work for him because he's so durable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think that he landed the bigger shots on Giga Chikadze in their fight.
No.
He just got hurt less by them.
That tends to be how it goes, man.
Yeah.
So I mean, like, yeah, he knows that he can just agree to exchange with absolutely everyone. And the only guys it's not going to work against are guys like Max Holloway.
Yeah. And it's guys that can put out enough output and in their offense
that he literally can't even get his shots off.
Like, yeah. Or that even if he does, it just doesn't matter because he's being swamped by volume, and it's not, you know, it's not playing the game of, oh, can I hit as hard as you? And can we mix it up and go for punch and who's going to win? It's okay. I'll throw four shots to every one of yours.
Yeah.
And what are you going to do? You've come here to box and throw head. You know, you've come here to throw huge punches, and I'm just going to throw a lot more punches.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not going to be Josh Emmett. Emmett's not that kind of pace fighter. Even if he doesn't gas, even if, as I said, he throws well on the front foot and the back foot, it's not, he's not out there setting the kind of metagame huge output pace that you're just like, wow, how would you even meet that?
No, you know? Let's see how many he threw against Burgos. That's got to be his highest output fight ever.
Yeah.
By a huge margin, it is.
Yeah.
He threw 266. Landed 127, and this was with a guy who was literally in range almost the entire fight.
Yeah, and Calvin Kattar has had his last three fights all look like that.
Yeah.
He may have only, you know, he may have lost the one to Max Holloway in the middle, but he threw 402 strikes against Giga Chikadze.
He threw 283 against Max Holloway. He attempted more in his loss to Max Holloway than Emmett did in his winning over Shane Burgos.
Yeah.
Granted, five rounds, not three, but still.
And he threw 260 against Dan Ige.
Yeah.
You know? He is already pretty attuned to that part of the MMA metagame of being a volume striker.
Point is that Emmett will probably be able to match Kattar's pace if it comes down to it. But if it's the kind of fight where Emmett is matching Kattar's pace, he's probably getting hurt worse. That to me is the linchpin.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I got to agree with you on that and pick Calvin Kattar. It's odd because it's the kind of thing where both men are going to get the fight they want, you know, like.
Sort of, yeah.
Josh Emmett is going to get to fight a Josh Emmett fight. He's going to have somebody right in front of him pushing forward right into his wheelhouse to hit. And Calvin Kattar is probably going to just get to push forward and throw a lot of volume.
Yeah.
You know, both men have some wrestling in their arsenal, but it's very much a plan C to wrestle.
Yeah.
Kattar's very much, he's got that... I almost want to just say New England style thing, because that Sit Yo Tong, New England Cartel, oh man, who's the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guy who used to fight in the UFC? Can't remember his name now.
Almeida? Ricardo Almeida?
Yeah, Ricardo Almeida. Like, all that kind of area. Like, it's all these guys are just kind of, like, there's, like, 10 gyms that just make up one general training group of people, you know? And one of the big things you see out of a lot of those guys is very much a, like, takedown seals the round kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's a lot of good kickboxing fundamentals, and then at the end of, in the last 30 seconds of the round, suddenly a takedown, shot takedown, get him down for a second, end the round on top, and that's about the end of the wrestling idea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much who Calvin Kattar is.
Yeah.
And for Josh Emmett, I mean, you know, he's a much more storied wrestler, a much more accomplished one, I believe, even if it wasn't, I don't know that he actually won any major things, but
I think it's a wash ultimately.
Yeah,
they're wrestling games.
I would expect Emmett to be maybe the slightly better wrestler in this, but he just has no interest in it.
No, yeah.
When he does it, it's every now and then. I think he's maybe had no. He's never. Yeah, he had one fight against Scott Holtzman, where he landed 8 takedowns early in his UFC career. And ever since then, the high watermark for any of his fights is 1.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not something, you know, he hits with power. He's in love with that. He's not going to go out there and try and use takedowns to take over a fight. He wants to slug it out.
It's mostly the same for Kattar.
Yeah.
He had a few more against Giga than he has ever since coming to the UFC, but it's mostly the same. It's seasoning on the basic game plan.
Yeah, and you can bet too that the Chikadze reasoning there is probably more due to Chikadze's creativity than his power. Man, this guy has the ability to surprise me. It would be good to get him off of his feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Emmett is not a surprise puncher. You can see he's powerful enough that even being able to see it coming, it still hurts a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, you know, he's not out there fooling people into thinking, I don't know what's coming.
I know, I just thought of Homer getting Marge a bowling ball for her birthday. Surprise! It's like, this is just what you wanted, Josh. It's a right hand. I'm not surprised. This is a gift for you.
Yeah.
I don't know why that's what jumped into my head. Or like AJ getting Carmella a DVD of The Matrix. Same gag.
Yeah. All right. We're both picking Kattar. Oddsmakers.
Anyway. Oh, yeah, I don't think I'll just say, by the way, I don't think my main prediction for that, what the fight looks like, is that it may not be a war to start, but it will become a war.
Yeah, I think at some point both these men hit hard enough and are durable enough.
Yeah.
That they're going to get stung very badly and realize that they need to start doing that to their opponent to make sure that they win this fight.
Yes.
Kattar opened at minus 170, dropped down to minus 212, is currently down at minus 238. Emmett opened at plus 145, jumped up to plus 181, currently plus 191. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's fine. It shouldn't get very wide, I don't think. You know, Kattar has kind of a push in his favor for getting the kind of fights he wants. He tends to win more of those kinds of fights the way he wants to, and he's been more durable, even though for Josh Emmett, really, the limit of his durability was getting his eye socket broken. It's not exactly replicable damage, you know?
Well, he got rocked first. I think it got broken on the ground in the follow-up.
Yeah, did it? I thought it got broken on the feet. Doesn't really matter.
I'm pretty sure he got...
He wasn't...
knocked down first.
Either way, he wasn't out. exactly.
No, no, no.
And so it's not one of those things where I expect Emmett, you know, you can't really just bank on Emmett being less durable.
He's not fragile. He's just like closer to human than Calvin Kattar, who like I can't even recall seeing Calvin Kattar get hurt.
Yeah, I'm trying
other to than I guess Max Holloway. I mean,
yeah.
Who just hit him with absolute so much that he just could not see any of the shots coming.
Yeah, Kattar's never been dropped in a fight.
Yeah, he's unbelievably tough.
Emmett has been dropped once by Jeremy Stephens.
Telling you, he got dropped and then the elbows on the ground broke his orbital.
Yeah. He still wasn't out at the end of the fight.
No, no, I think you're right.
All right. That brings us to a lightweight bout. Donald Cerrone, Joe Lauzon. We've already talked about this.
Yep.
I think you picked Cerrone, if I'm remembering correctly. Maybe not.
I can't remember. I think I might have, for fun, picked Joe Lauzon. I
outright picked Joe Lauzon.
Both pick Joe Lauzon, because okay. our theory is that it's now's the time, where this is a fight that Joe Lauzon would have lost.
Yeah.
And now he might win it until he possibly still loses it the same way.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a chance that that Lauzon or that Cerrone, you know, Lauzon, that he hits a hard enough wall.
Yeah.
That Cerrone can actually get his game clicking over again the way it's supposed to. But it's just been so hard for him to get into a rhythm, you know? Those classic slow starts for him have turned into just slow performances where he's never getting out of gear or getting into gear rather.
Mm-hmm.
And for Lauzon, you at least know that he's going to start fast. You know that he's still for one round or for part of a round, Joe Lauzon is still the same guy he used to be. So I got to pick Joe Lauzon just on that. Because I know that I'm going to get a few minutes of Joe Lauzon looking a lot like Joe Lauzon. And I cannot guarantee I'm going to get any time of Donald Cerrone looking like Donald Cerrone.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. Odds on the bout. Cerrone opened at minus 170. Currently minus 169. Not a lot of movement on it. Lauzon over to plus 145, currently plus 140. Yeah, I mean, I know Cerrone's hit higher highs, and like we both said, this is a fight that classic slow start Cerrone would not have been overly troubled by Joe Lauzon, because a lot of what Joe Lauzon has done in the past has been really, you know, the club and sub path, where he comes mm-hmm. out and he looks to hit really hard and chain that into a submission early. Although, looking at it wildly, it's been nine years since Joe Lauzon submitted somebody.
That is unbelievable.
Ten years.
Was Jamie Varner?
Yeah.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't expect him to submit Cerrone anyway.
Yeah, but the idea would be that, like, you know, even slow start Cerrone, you have to knock him out. You're not going to really easily just, like, hurt him and then out-grapple him. He was always a very good grappler.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, he's getting hurt worse early, and he's getting hurt now to the point where things don't click. They don't fall into place. You know, that fight with Nico Price was just a long series of waiting to see if Donald Cerrone would actually find a way into this fight
mm-hmm.
against exactly the kind of wild, like, unstructured dude that he used to school as time went on. And he just never did.
He's a year older than Joe and has like 14 more fights.
Yeah. All right. So
I mean, I still think if Joe Lozon doesn't knock him out, but even then, I don't know, man. Exactly. I just do not trust Donald Cerrone anymore.
Yeah, it's just he's getting to that point where it just doesn't seem to, the momentum doesn't start.
Yeah. Because even Lozon had that fight. I'm sure we said this exact thing last time, but he had that fight with like Stevie Ray.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, it didn't work early. He's actually still kind of hanging in there and being tough the rest of the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's had a lot of experience, too. And I think what Joe Lozon has gained from that experience is that he doesn't have to crumple the moment he starts to feel tired and the early finish evaporates. He can kind of, I think he's learned a little more staying power in the later stages of his career.
Getting TKO'd by Chris Gritzmacher is still pretty rough.
Oh, yeah. No doubt.
So.
They're both washed.
They're both washed. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just like, it's the fast start versus the slow start thing. And at this point, I don't trust Cerrone's slow start to turn into anything. All right. Mm-hmm. Let's move on. We'll have to wait about Kevin Holland, Tim Means, and this is kind of a tricky fight to call.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. Because
Kevin Holland.
Because Kevin Holland is, he's just kind of a wild man. But also, I think deep down at their core, he and Tim Means both have kind of the same, like, philosophy in the fight. Like, Tim Means is, he's not out there talking his way through it. It's more the stoic
Tim Means doesn't even talk to his wife.
Yeah. Tim Means last opened his mouth in like 2004 I don't know.
Working in a coal mine to tell that a boulder was about to crush him. Hey.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah. But they both thrive when they feel like they can school some young punk.
Hmm.
You know? Like, that has become more and more evident to me of Holland over his career,
mm-hmm.
is that he really values a mentorship role in the octagon.
When he was actively mentoring Joaquin Buckley.
Yeah. And he'll do a lot of posturing and a lot of talking and a lot of whatever else he wants around that. Especially to just, maybe even just to hide when he's not in control, to make him feel more like he's in mm-hmm. control. Kind of like Jiří Procházka getting beat up by Glover Teixeira last week and being mm-hmm. like, hey, good job, buddy. And like patting him on the side and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a good way to like fool yourself into keeping your cool.
Yeah, I'm having a good time.
Yeah. But he really... Things go best for Holland when he can just command his opponent.
Yeah.
And that's very much how it is for Means. You know, he is absolutely at his best when he can get somebody to respect him a little bit and start showing them how practiced his technique is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a cleaner striker than Holland and maybe a cleaner wrestler too. It's not nearly the grappler Holland is. Though
Kevin still doesn't really have a wrestling game.
Yeah. Kevin still really doesn't have a wrestling game.
He's shown, I would say, even more than technical growth, just a more awareness that someone is trying to take him down and that maybe he doesn't want it to happen. But even that is purely defensive so far. Yeah.
It's true.
It does look like probably a striking battle. I mean, there is the clinch where Kevin's got some skills, but so does Tim Means. Tim Means is a pretty nasty clinch fighter himself. So who knows? A Holland like clinch to body lock kind of route to get Means down and grind on him, that might be a very good way to play this fight.
Mm-hmm.
If it's at range, I kind of am favoring Tim Means. Weird as it is to say, like the difficult thing is that Kevin Holland, in that last fight with Cowboy Oliveira, who I think has physically declined a bit.
Yeah.
Even so, Kevin Holland looked like the crazy athlete in that fight.
Yeah.
Like, welterweight Kevin Holland does feel different from middleweight Kevin Holland.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just like undersized rubber band man anymore. He's like, he's kind of big and shredded at welterweight.
Yeah.
And he's always been quick and had underrated power. I still don't think he's like very physically strong in tie-ups, but I think there's more a feeling of him being able to just bully people at welterweight, which should be great for him.
Based
on what you said at the top. And I wonder about that. I mean, how many guys has Tim Means fought who are like Tim Means sized? He's usually taller and longer than the guys he really beats up. Let's see.
Yeah.
He's 6'2", 75-inch reach. Kevin Holland, 6'3", 81-inch reach.
Yeah, 6-inch reach advantage is what I was just going to say.
Crazy long arms.
Yeah.
That's an unusual thing. But, you know, reach is most effective if you're going to, like, maintain your position behind it, if you're going to keep your balance and keep your distance.
It's true.
And Kevin is just such a inconsistent boxer.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes he can do that and look really sharp. When he was the much taller guy against Joaquin Buckley, that was like a fantastic boxing performance from him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went in there and fought Cowboy, and it was like the stupidest, ugliest striking I've ever seen. It was a mess, that fight.
Yeah.
I don't know. I am going to pick Tim Means. I just trust him more. He's a super reliable fighter in striking exchanges. And I think Kevin Holland is the young one here.
Yeah.
Tim Means is going to want to teach him a lesson. And Tim Means has this attitude of just, sometimes it gets him into trouble, but he has this scary attitude of just, any exchange you want, I'm there, because you're going to make a mistake.
Yeah.
And I'm going to punish you for it. And maybe he's not the most like devastating hitter. Maybe he's not flawless defensively, but everything flows together so well, and he doesn't care. He wants to be in the exchanges to make you pay for your mistakes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to pick him. I know he's old and everything, but I just feel like I don't trust Kevin to win against such a crafty striker.
Yeah. The thing that's getting in my way with Tim Means really in this fight is that, because he is also so determined in that way to like, I'm going to enter this exchange and teach you a lesson.
Yeah.
He does get hit a lot.
Sure.
It's one of those things, like, he's actually a really crafty defensive fighter and mm-hmm. a really crafty puncher. And, you know, he's got a lot of good technique in the pocket, but because he's so dedicated to stepping in and creating exchanges,
yeah,
he gets hit a lot. And Holland, when it's not consistent or clean, but man, can he whip some tight, evil counters
as
people step in on him.
Yeah, Kevin's got power for sure.
And he will just torque his whole body. I think he's gonna win this. I think he's got the range to make it really difficult on Means, where he has to get hit a lot more than he would from further out as he's stepping in. And I think Collins big enough and powerful enough that he can hurt Means the way that, somebody like Nico Price did.
Yeah. I think if Kevin actually fights this like the tall guy,
yeah,
he can probably win until a chance to Nico Price him arises.
Yeah. Because I was thinking, what other big, lanky dudes has Tim Means fought lately? And the only one that came up to, that comes up is Laureano Staropoli. And I was like, okay, well, he went up to middleweight. He's 6'1". He has a 71.5-inch reach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, giving up 4 inches of reach even to Tim Means.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think Holland can make this honestly like just enough of a problem with the dynamic that Tim Means loves to have to win this fight. So I'll stick with Holland.
Holland Very is, interesting matchup.
Yeah, it is. It is, definitely. I like Holland at welterweight, I'll admit.
Yeah, me too.
Holland opened at -310, jumped up to -225, is currently down at -276. Means opened at +260, dropped to +189, is currently up at +221. So those odds are getting wider. I mean, I get it. Means is 38, and he's never been a dude that, like, gets any love. You know, maybe that's why the, like, cold, silent, gruffness has settled on his soul.
Mm-hmm.
Just a complete lack of a worldly affection. But you can't write him off, you know? I'm not sure the odds should be getting that wide because Kevin Holland will make all kinds of mistakes. And
Means has won three in a row, man. He's not done.
Yeah, he's not done. He had a bad, he hit a bad spot, but he seems to have recovered. He seems to have pushed past it somehow.
And even then, I'm not sure how bad a spot it really was. Like, he was whooping Nico Price's ass.
Yeah.
Destroying him before Price landed one shot to come back. And then the other one, Daniel Rodriguez, is like, I don't know, one of the best welterweight fringe contenders now.
Like, it only really looked and felt bad because Tim Means had never been knocked out before.
Yeah.
And then he got hurt in the Rodriguez fight too. And you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
Is this the start of him getting hurt regularly?
Yeah.
But it hasn't happened in the last three fights.
Yeah, but that's part of a streak for Rodriguez that's only broken by one surprising loss to Nicholas Dalby. Like, that guy is really, really good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think Tim Means he's slowing down. He's 38 years old or something like that, but he's still got it. I do not think he should be a big dog here because Kevin, you can't trust Kevin.
No. He doesn't even want you to trust him, if I remember correctly.
No, you can't trust him. He's going to do something stupid. It might work anyway, but
yeah,
you just, Tim Means is a very reliably good fighter.
Yep. All right. That brings us to a middleweight bout. Joaquin Buckley, Albert Duraev. And this is the kind of fight, this is one of those times where, you know, if we're talking about how, Tim Means and Kevin Holland have set attitudes that underpin their game, this like sort of, let me tell you something kind of attitude to their styles of schooling young guys. Buckley seems to also be channeled into a style of fighting and an attitude that just means that he can lose to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really kind of frustrating because, honestly, on the face of it, I would just say this is a fight that Buckley should absolutely win. Albert Duraev's striking is a mess. And his wrestling is not bad, but it's not connected to anything. If you're set up to sniff out his wrestling game, you're not going to see a lot of parts that fool you into not expecting it.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to see some ugly, wild striking in the hopes that he can get inside far enough to shoot. And Buckley should be able to solve that problem.
Should be.
He's got some good, he's got some okay wrestling defense at times. He's not a bad offensive wrestler in his own right. And he is a much more polished power puncher. But he's so tracked into being a powerful puncher, into being a powerful fighter in general, that everything still happens on a straight line.
Yeah.
It's all just drop back and prepare for the next blitz in. And, you know, I'm going to be able to meet you with something that you can't handle. And it makes him incredibly predictable. You know, even Abdul Razak Al-Hassan was able to see his rest takedown entries coming eventually and was able to time him over and over again.
It was one of the most blockheaded fights I've ever seen.
Yeah. Like, Al-Hassan is even more predictable than Buckley, which is why Buckley was able to start out just kind of running over him. But even to, you know, Buckley is still, it's so one note, one speed, one tempo, one idea that it's just not hard to figure him out.
Yeah.
So he's probably going to, you know, he's going to give Duraev a lot to work with. Probably a lot of reactive double leg opportunities. I'm still going to pick Buckley. Just because this is a fight he should be able to win.
He really should.
But if he loses it, I'm not going to be that shocked. He got beat by Alessio De Chirico. I don't want to, you know, slag off De Chirico, but it's the only win De Chirico has had since 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just because you know where Buckley's going to be. All the time.
Yeah, I'm going to side with you. I mean, I'm going to say that at the very least that I can understand what the thought process was against Abdul Razak Al-Hassan.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, that's a very, like, you can, like, feel yourself winning the fight and you have, like, the most, like, big brain five head solution, which is like, this guy hates wrestling. I'm going to destroy myself wrestling him.
Yeah.
I'm going to exhaust myself wrestling him. But you can see the logic there at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one thing Buckley's going to want to do against Duraev, right?
Yeah.
Is just hit him.
Yeah.
He's going to keep doing the stuff that Buckley's already good at.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to assume that he's going to win. I don't think there are any catastrophically bad mistakes he could allow himself to make here. And then the normal range of mistakes are not typically punished by guys like Duraev. So
yeah,
I'll take Buckley too.
It is worth noting with that Duraev, like, he came out and he got mount on Roman Kapilov and nearly had him out of there pummeling him and then almost lost that fight in the final round just because he was tired and his striking game is so unpolished and one note that once he was tired, he basically had nothing.
Yeah.
He had no way to compete standing up. And it's really kind of just a testament to how light fisted Kapilov is that fight went all the way to the bell and Duraev won it.
Mm-hmm.
Buckley, that's not going to happen. Even when Buckley gets tired, he still hits really hard. He's one of those dudes who he can be absolutely gassed, and he's still got the form on his punches.
He's one of those guys too, where there are actually a couple moments against Al-Hassan where he kind of got better for being tired, where he was easing up and making better decisions and thinking more about where to place his shots and less about making sure each one hit as hard as possible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Buckley is the pick.
Buckley is the underdog here. Opened at +140, jumped up to +167, currently at +180. Duraev is opened at -160, dropped to -195, currently -223. I mean, I get the general idea. Russian wrestler, you don't pick against them kind of thing. Chechen, even. But it's just, you know, I don't have a lot of faith. And I don't think that Kapilov win means all that much, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that brings us to a lightweight bout. Demir Ismagulov, Guram Khatadladze, And yeah, this is a hell of a good fight.
Great matchup. It has been a very long time since Kutataladze fought.
Mm-hmm.
In his, was that debut against
Gamrot.
Was that short notice?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so he came out of nowhere. And like, I've already in like discussing this fight elsewhere, have like forgotten who won that fight like four times. Because it's just like absolutely razor close.
Yeah, Kutataladze won it.
But essentially fought a very good fighter in Mateusz Gamrot like to a stalemate.
Mm-hmm.
In a short notice debut. And looked super good doing it. Like he even at points allowed Gamrot to sort of do the thing that usually wins him fights, which is just like insanely active rinse and repeat wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And his grappling was top notch. He was threatening submissions. He was creating he was creating imbalances and sweeping, and he was just scrambling free every single time. And the downside of that is that he didn't get a lot done on the feet.
No.
And if he were fighting somebody who wasn't Mateusz Gamrot, who like knew how to put strikes together with his takedowns and could do it all and had more depth basically everywhere, I think he might have had to fight a lot harder to stay in that.
Yeah.
And I think that's Damir Ismagulov.
I agree.
Ismagulov is a much, much better striker than Gamrot. He's just a very well-schooled boxer, great jab, uses it really well to close the distance, to set up other strikes. Excellent footwork. Like, he is just a really well put together technical boxer. And on top of that, he loves taking people down.
Yeah.
And he is also, I think Gamrot's style sort of allows for, oh, let's have a crazy scramble. Like, he's like a pace grappler, Gamrot.
Yeah.
I think he's predisposed to allow the kinds of things Kutataladze wanted. To the kind of grappling exchanges Kutataladze was forcing him into, because typically most people can't keep up with that.
Yeah.
And Kutataladze, I think, surprised him, especially on short notice, by being able to do that.
Kutataladze is definitely a hell of an athlete.
Oh, man.
There's no question about that.
Yeah, but Ismagulov is a blanket.
Yes, he is.
He takes you down, like, you have to work really, really hard to get back up. And he's not going to make it easy for you. He's not going to allow a crazy scramble because it seems fun or he thinks it's going to take it out of you. He's like, I'm on top of you.
Yeah.
Your turn. So I'm going to take Ismagulov. I think he's just a more active striker. I don't think Kutataladze can sort of just stay away from him as well as he could away from Gamrot. And I think that is going to lead to cleaner takedowns with better top control.
Yeah, and also... that's interesting, actually. Ismagulov is actually shorter than Kutataladze. He's shorter than I thought he was. He's only 5'10".
Mm-hmm.
Does have a longer reach, though, which Gamrot did not have.
Mm-hmm.
Gamrot's got an exceptionally short reach, even at 5'10 himself. Which is, if you want to look to it, like, why, you know, at the kind of struggles Gamrot was having from range against Kutataladze and the kind of long boxing game that Ismagulov has, him having a reach advantage in this fight might make that, you know, it might make that a lot harder of a fight for Kutataladze, who is, you know, he's certainly a very powerful, sharp striker, but he's also kind of a, you know, select one strike power hitter.
Yeah.
It's not a volume striking approach.
No.
At least not that we've seen to date. And, I mean, the worry here for Ismagulov is that, and this is a real concern against Kutataladze, is that we've now seen against another very, very good athlete that... being a blanket and pushing the kind of fight he wants can tire Ismagulov out. Like, I don't think he's that good. You know, I don't think he's an elite athlete. He's a really well-schooled, well-rounded, well-coached, high IQ fighter who could go a long way because of that. But he's not the cream of the crop when it comes to speed and power and explosive, you know, dynamic offense.
Yeah.
And when he had that fight against Rafael Alves, who is absolutely a athletic wild man and less structured than Cataladze. Like, by the end of that fight, Ismagulov was exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that fight pushed him to the edge. And you get the feeling, if it had been like a 5-round fight, Alves might have even come back and won it. Because Ismagulov was exhausted from just trying to keep control of him. I could absolutely see that happening with Cataladze. If he can create enough scrambles, if he can land big shots standing whenever he has the chance, he could just put Ismagulov in a point where he's forcing the fight so heavily to try to keep it in control that he pushes himself past the point of his cardio.
That's true.
But over a 3-round fight, I would still assume that Ismagulov is going to win 2 rounds of that. You know?
Yeah. And I don't know exactly what Cataladze does to capitalize on an exhausted Ismagulov. I mean, the good thing about being a rock solid technician is that most of the things still kind of work when you're dead tired.
Yeah.
So the opponent still has to force those cracks open. And to do that, you need like some volume. You need, I don't know. I think just more aggression than I've really seen out of Cataladze.
Yeah. It seems more like even in a good 3rd round, Cataladze could land something really big on Ismagulov and make him have to get defensive. But, you know, is he going to find a way to surprise Ismagulov so much so that he can knock him out?
Mm-hmm.
And that seems unlikely. So, yeah, I'm going to side with you and take Demir Ismagulov here. But I love the fight. And I just want to see more Cataladze. If this means a step back for him after this fight, that's fine. Like, just get him in the cage more, because I want to see him develop. I want to see more of what he can do.
Yeah. Well, it was supposed to be Don Madge.
Yeah. It's which true.
Frankly, been a much kinder matchup for Cataladze.
Yeah. No kidding. Odds on the bout: Ismagulov is the favorite. Opened at minus 180, jumped up to minus 148, currently at a minus 164. Cataladze opened at plus 155, dropped down to plus 126, and is currently at plus 134. Should also be noted that as good as Cataladze's grappling is, his reactive wrestling instincts are not good.
Mm.
Like Alves, it's going to make things really kind of difficult for him. He's going to put himself in positions where he has to fight. Out of bad grappling spots.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That brings us to our final fight of the main card. Middleweight bout. Julian Marquez, Gregory Rodriguez. And
old Hobocop.
Hobocop. And this should be a wild fight. Marquez is trying to build a more technical game for himself.
Mm-hmm.
But as a short-armed middleweight himself, as a short-armed dude himself, there always comes a point where he has to abandon it.
Yeah.
You know, that Sam Alvey fight, he came out. He was working behind the jab. He was playing smart. He was trying, you know, he was just backing Sam Alvey up and taking whatever Alvey gave him. Credit to Alvey. He actually tried to fight off the cage more than usual. But the end result was still that Marquez eventually, when he got close enough to where he could hit Alvey, Alvey could hit him. And he had to counter that by just swinging harder and going after Alvey with bigger shots. Wasn't really an option, you know. And that seems very likely to happen with Gregory Rodriguez as well, because even if Rodriguez doesn't have a long reach himself, it's longer than Marquez's, and he throws good straight chambered shots.
Mm-hmm.
So if Marquez is walking in, is trying to press him, pressure and push him back, which I'm sure he will be, he's going to walk onto strikes. And when he starts walking onto strikes, he's going to answer with bigger strikes. After that, there's always an opportunity for Rodriguez to turn fights in his favor.
Yeah.
To actually, like, you know, I mean, Marquez, for his, you know, he loves to instigate a scrambling grappling game. He's a strong guy. He's an opportunistic fighter. So a lot of that works for him. But like Alessio De Chirico did, just kind of was able to just hold him down
and so was, push him against the cage. So was Maki Chitolo.
Yeah, for large parts of that bout. It's really Marquez really, he lives on his indomitability, if that's right. Even a word, in those situations where you can't break him. You can't stop him from thinking he can fight his way out.
Mm-hmm.
And Rodriguez should be a high enough level grappler to stuff that and to stifle that over and over again. But he doesn't necessarily choose to.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to do cool shit on the ground too.
Yeah.
Like, I think this is a fight where Rodriguez really could win it without too much difficulty if he just really prioritized his wrestling, which is very strong, by the way. I mean, yeah. The guy hit some great takedowns and just tried to control Marquez. And I think he could. He's a super strong positional grappler. He's a great athlete himself. And again, yeah, if like Maki Pitolo can like hold you down for minutes at a time, Gregory Rodriguez can do it. The thing is eventually Marquez is going to force some kind of scramble. He's going to give up his back, and yeah, maybe Rodriguez can choke him out, but maybe he just goes for it and Marquez just never accepts the bad position once the scramble begins and gets out.
Yeah.
And then Rodriguez gets tired. That's the concern.
Yep. I think I'm going to pick Julian Marquez here. I think he can go out there and he can get his kind of fight against Gregory Rodriguez, and he can break him down at some point, whether it's with punches or just with scrambles or just, yeah, a mess. I think Marquez can end up in one and fight his way out of it in a way that we've seen him do
every many time.
Yeah.
win or lose, every single fight is like a complete mess.
And for Rodriguez, like, we've just, even with his success, we've seen too many fights where he fights down to the level of his opponent.
Yeah. He gets tired. He's a bit fragile.
Or, you know, like even the Jun Yong Park fight, like he just went out there and just traded hammers with Jun Yong Park.
Yeah.
And he got lucky enough to land the bigger ones, but Julian Marquez has never been knocked out.
Yeah, and that was after demonstrating that he could actually just outgrapple Park.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm kind of inclined to agree with you. Even though like it's one of those things where like there are so many ways for Rodriguez to win this fight.
Yeah.
But all of them rely on a sort of hypothetical of like he has to make this decision that he doesn't usually make.
Yeah.
And whereas Marquez is reliable, you know exactly, it's going to look like a different kind of mess every time, but you know exactly how he's going to approach every fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, I kind of assume that Marquez might be getting thrashed, and then at some point an insane exchange that where Rodriguez just gets hurt worse.
Yeah, I especially think he might be getting thrashed, because I think the thing with Marquez really at this point is a desire to get better and not a clear roadmap to getting better.
Yeah.
Where like he's going to come out with new ideas and stuff he's been working on, and he'll just, you know, it just won't work for several minutes.
Yeah. Well, it's not even entirely impossible that he can kind of hang at range like Rodriguez.
Yeah.
Doesn't always make the best decisions, and he had a tough fight with that dude last time out.
Yeah. Rodriguez, I mean, he will always himself, he will walk himself out of range, and he will always be there with his head online. Like, he doesn't, it's not even a question of walking himself into or out of range, I should say. It's that he is so perfectly there to be hit, because I mean, he's throwing straight down the middle with his head on the line. Like, there's no deception about where anything, you follow the arm back
to the source. And I think his attitude is one that reason that I really like him and I admire the way he fights is I think his attitude is like, you're going to come in at me doing some wild shit.
Yeah.
I'm going to maintain this controlled position and punish you with better shots.
Yeah.
And it's just that he ends up looking a little old and ragged because it's fighting isn't just all about technique. And he's a great technical striker, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, Armin Petrosian was the guy. But, you know, he just kind of moved around and threw a lot of, like, low kicks and body kicks.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't look great. Arguably didn't win, but... It's not like Marquez can't have a close fight trying his new outfit of technical fighter on.
Yeah.
And then when it gets to one of the ugly points, like it did against Petrosian, Marquez is going to brawl like a maniac.
Yep.
Which Rodriguez doesn't really want.
No. Odds on the bout. Rodriguez is the favorite here. Opened at -110, dropped to -194, currently -185. Julian Marquez opened at -110, jumped to +165, currently +154. Those odds are starting to get a little closer. I mean, I'm a little surprised. I won't be, you know, I won't lie. Like, Rodriguez, I know he's huge and he looks like a killer and he's got, you know, he's got all these different tools. But we just saw him lose a split to Armin Petrosian, just like fighting the wrong fight. And
yeah.
I love Junyuan Park, but he's always going to be, you know, I'm always worried about Park because he's not an athletic middleweight.
Mm-hmm.
And then otherwise you've got Dusko Todorovic, who looks and fights like Gregory Rodriguez, but without all of the benefit of actual technique. And like those, you know, they're not bad wins, but beating Phil Haas and Darren Stewart and I don't know, like there's nothing really about these fights that I would be picking Rodriguez for his recent performances over Marquez.
Yeah, I'm with you. I just think Marquez thrives in a mess and Rodriguez is not proven to be particularly good at avoiding those.
Yep. All right. On that note, we're going to wrap it up. You can find me on Twitter at TheZaneSimon. You can find Connor on Twitter at BoxingBush. You can find both of us over at BloodyOla.com. Give us a like, subscribe to our podcasts on Bloody Oak Presents on SoundCloud, YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, all those good places. And as always, the MMA Vivid section is brought to you by The Fine Art of Fighting, written by and developed by Chris Rini. You can find his book over at chrisrini.com, chrisrini.com. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and we will see you soon.
Thank you for listening to this Bloody Elbow Presents production. To check out more of our content, hop over to the Bloody Elbow Presents SoundCloud and iTunes pages, as well as subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is titled Bloody Elbow Presents. We are also on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Player FM, and Amazon Music. Just search for Bloody Elbow Presents, and you will get brand new shows throughout the week, including Care Don't Care, The Mookie and Crookie Show, The MMA Vivisection, The Level Change Podcast, The Sixth Round Post-Fight Show, Sixth Round Retro, The MMA Depressed Us, Crooklyn's Corner, Exclusive Fighter Interviews, Show Money, and radio-style play-by-play for every UFC pay-per-view. Be sure to also follow us on Twitter, at Bloody Elbow, Facebook at facebook.com/bloodyelbowblog, and as always, on bloodyelbow.com.